Welcome to the Open Source Textbook Task Force. I'm going to ask the members of the task force who could be present today to go ahead and introduce themselves.
I am Kevin Corcoran from the Connecticut Distance Learning Consortium and co-chair of the task force.
I am Martha Bedard, Vice Provost of Libraries for the University of Connecticut and co-chair of the task force.
I am Christopher Clark, Professor and Head of the Department of History at the University of Connecticut and a member of the task force.
I am Cindy Gallatin, Vice President for Online Programs at Quinnipiac University and a member of the task force.
I'm Pat Bannock, Director of Library Services at Eastern Connecticut State University, a member of the task force.
And I'm Chris Kirker-Stewart, in the Office of Higher Education, also a member of the task force.
Great. Well, let's get started. Our first order of business is the approval of the minutes. Mary Ann distributed them to you earlier. Do we have any corrections, additions?
I do want to note that Pat Bannock did submit revisions that I have submitted up to Mary Ann.
For the good of the whole, Pat, do you want to tell us what it is that you suggested we revise?
Sure. On the bottom of page one, where it says Representative Haddad expresses concern over how an adequate email list will be obtained, I suggested a revision to the last part of that sentence, paragraph, actually. And what I have suggested now reads, Pat Bannock suggested that it is a possibility to use the Council of Connecticut Academic Library Directors listserv to distribute the surveys to the participating library directors and ask them to forward to their campus provost. The provost would distribute to the faculty. The previous version said the Connecticut Provost Library Database, and I don't know that there is a Connecticut Provost Library Database, so I think what was meant was the Council of Connecticut Academic Library Directors listserv.
Thanks for that clarification. Is everyone all right with that? So I will call for approval of the minutes. All in favor? Any opposed? We're all accounted for, so there can be no abstain. So there we go. The minutes are approved. Well, thank you. Oh, that's wonderful. We were just introducing ourselves since we are being publicly recorded. So if you wouldn't mind, you need to step up to a microphone. I'm sorry. Oh, it's wonderful. We are planning his future.
I'm Jim Brunt. I'm an associate English professor at Gateway.
Who am I speaking to? That's it.
Oh, okay.
We are speaking to Connecticut Television Network viewers. Okay. Kevin and I met a couple of times in person and on the phone and discussed the nature of the subcommittees and the role of the subcommittees, the amount of subcommittees, and the folks who had signed up. So I think, Kevin, you probably took the best notes. If not, I have some notes from our discussion. But what we were really asked for from the members was to clarify and speak more about the charge and the time frame. So, Kevin?
The original intent we were going to do is review the current volunteers. If we had a fuller session, call for additional volunteers, and then talk a little bit about the action items. When we were discussing the the working groups. I think that's the new terminology we're going to use instead of subcommittees is working groups. We saw that there may have been some opportunities to combine the work groups since we had in total 5 plus groups. Now we've condensed it down to 4, and there may be an opportunity to even go further than that. But one of the first working groups we had was really working on the content or messaging around the survey based on the Babson group. So folks who have identified themselves as volunteers to this working group are Dan Barrett, Jim Brunt, Clara Ogba, and myself, Kevin Corcoran. And when Martha and I were sort of talking about what the call to action would be for this working group, it would really be to review what the original Babson survey was, what North Dakota did for supplemental questions, the original Babson, and also to review the revised version that the University of Connecticut distributed, and then make suggestions based on those three versions on what supplemental questions might be needed. Beyond that, we were hoping that the group would also develop messaging that would be sent out not only to the Connecticut Board of Regents of Higher Ed, but also the Connecticut Council for Independent Colleges. And the nature of that message was to be twofold. One is expressing that the importance of surveying faculty and that a survey was forthcoming. And the second one was actually the distribution of the survey, and again, encouraging faculty to participate in that survey. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, the University of Connecticut will not be part of the distribution because they've already done a very similar initiative, and they didn't want to inundate their faculty with a survey request that was so similar to the original one.
However, we are willing to distribute and manage it. So when we talk about the difference between the survey content and the survey operations and who will be on that committee, I think we should, we'll get there then.
Perfect transition. So the secondary working group that we were discussing was around survey operations. So really about the construction of the survey once all of the supplemental questions were put together, distribution of the survey, what type of tool, I believe it's Qualtrics, is going to be used, and then analysis of the data. So the folks who volunteered for this committee are Clara Ogba, Chris Clark, Martha Bedard, Sally Reese, and Kevin Corcoran.
For the record, I volunteered Sally Reese because she actually offered to have her office staff help administer the survey. I believe that Pat's suggestion, I mean, that I think was one of our big issues, is how do we get it to those faculty outside of UConn, and I really appreciate it. So maybe, Pat, you could be kind of an advisor to the committee the distribution, at least, of it. We'll do the analysis.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's not the only way we could distribute it, obviously, but that's one way we would reach a large number of academic libraries, and then we could look at the ones that may not be participating in that list and make sure that they get it also.
Sally also offered to get in touch with the president or chief academic officer of the Board of Regents and facilitate that conversation, although I know Kevin is in good contact with them too, to see if we can pick up the other schools that way. So I think once we have the content and the questions, then we can just get moving.
Yeah, I think making sure that the provosts are aware that it's coming is also a good thing.
That's the
yeah.
I think that's the messaging part. So the task force on survey content will also be asked to draft a message. Is that my understanding? So they're messaging, and I can certainly give you examples of what we sent out as part of UConn, or you may not need that at all.
I'd like to suggest that CCIC perhaps be in the loop on that as well, so that they could actually reach out to presidents of the independent colleges.
Great. That's great. So it might be useful for us to put a time frame on this. I know it's very busy over the summer, but much of this work does not have to be done in person. And I think that the that the meat of the survey is probably there in the UConn survey that was an adaption of the Babson. It was just this, some members of this committee suggested additional questions. So I think that's really probably, although I don't want to assume that when the group meets, you know, they don't want to go in a different direction. So what do you think in terms of time? You're the only representative from that committee here, so you get to decide.
I'm not certain what Dan's schedule is. I'd have to check and see what he has planned for the summer and Claire as well. I'm not sure what you're thinking, but I'm fairly open right now. But
and unfortunately, Dan couldn't attend today, but what I can do is I can reach out to the working group on Monday, and we can sort of coordinate calendars and see where we can go from there.
That works, yeah.
That's perfect. So if you could communicate to us when that deadline is, then I'll take the lead with the survey and operations aspects.
So working in somewhat of a logical order of having the survey content in the messaging set and moving on to operations, we had the conversation that there was a lot of crossover between awareness and data collection, and so the suggestion was to combine those, mostly because the volunteers for those two items were duplicative or the same. So the thought was, based on the survey results and what we deemed might be the needs, that we would focus on what types of materials, what types of training, or what types of content would just need to be developed to assist with awareness. So there's a collection element of the awareness campaign of what other materials have already been developed by other entities that we could reuse, repurpose. But beyond that, the collection is also around awareness on the campus and identifying faculty who are already working around OER adoption or adaption and collecting data on those efforts as well. So the members of that team, or the volunteers of that team, are Susan Dean from Charter Oak State College, Pat Bannock, Cindy Gallatin, and myself.
Does that sound reasonable?
So that working group is a little bit down the road based on the survey distribution and analysis of the data. The last group that we have is currently titled Tools, and I think it's a catch-all piece on sort of a R&D or a review and analysis of what tools are available to the OER community or to this task force or to our constituents in general. So it may be from a authoring platform standpoint, a repository standpoint, a remix redistribution standpoint. It could be a number of things regarding in the tools piece. I think it was meant to be sort of a catch-all. And right now, the folks on that working group are Dan Barrett, Jim Brunt, Cindy Gallatin, and Martha Bedard. Any feedback on the nature of that last group, the tools analysis?
And I think it could also be tools of how to evaluate an open educational resource. I mean, there are some good tools out there, and that may be part of workshops, but we want to make sure that so. And a tool could be considered a website. So we've already opened, we already have a website, but, you know, I think tools are pretty broadly used in this context. And I might go out and try to solicit some other members to try to work through this.
I was wondering if we construe tools potentially as some of the libguides that have been developed at the various libraries, mm-hmm. which is not the same, of course, as a repository, but they are becoming pretty common, and making sure that every campus actually has a place for faculty to look, whether it's the LibGuide or something else, would probably be a good thing.
Thanks. That was actually part of my notes, since that's how many of the library communities started. So thank you for that. And as we move forward, any other ideas for what tools you come across will be helpful. But once again, I think that's we can't be too far down the road, but further down the road. These are sort of, each one is predicated on the results of the next.
Well, and one thing that's nice about what we're doing here, since it's OER, there are quite a few OER LibGuides out there which are in themselves OER. Yes. So it doesn't have to be starting over from scratch to, you know, take some of the best of what's already out there with permission from some of our colleagues elsewhere.
Yep, that's right.
Were there any other thoughts or comments around the working groups? Did we miss a major topic? Considering that we're looking at these working groups in somewhat of a chronological order of content to operations to awareness, does anybody want to volunteer for additional responsibilities, or do we want to stay the course with what we have right now? All right, not hearing anything. I think we can move on to the next topic. Now, we've allocated a little bit extra time to this discussion, I guess in anticipation of having more folks on the committee here. We did invite Jeremy Smith from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst to speak at 2 o'clock, and since we're doing great on time, we may need to jump agenda items and move down to updates.
Marion, how closely do we have to stick to this agenda for topics? Okay, good. I was just a little bit worried. Okay. So while we're awaiting Jeremy, I'm wondering if there are any updates from each of the campuses.
You want me to start?
I'd love for you to start.
Okay. Well, I did send Kevin some information about what Eastern has done, and I don't necessarily recap all of that because some of it has been discussed before, but I did recently get in touch with our provost and reminded him of this committee and suggested that it might be a good idea if I make a presentation in the fall to the president's extended staff. And he was quite receptive to that. So I'm hoping to do that to increase awareness at that level because it's important for the faculty to be aware they're primary, but it's also important for the administration to understand the importance of this for our students.
I don't have any updates this time.
Okay, great. Chris?
I don't have updates. You have the updates from you.
Well, it is awfully quiet time on the campus. We still have UConn has an internal campus-wide task force working on this issue. I recently met with a graduate student who had some great ideas. Well, he was asked to create a curriculum for a course for the very first time that he'll be teaching in the fall. And this was just part of a, you know, something that came up in an overall conversation of OER and suggested that that might be a constituency group in addition to faculty that we reach out to early in the process. I guess I was unaware of, you know, the number of graduate students who are called upon, you know, to create a course. I mean, I certainly knew they were teaching them, but great GAs and TAs. So it seems like a good idea. I'll definitely add one to the University of Connecticut's task force. and we have plenty of undergrads. Undergrads expressing a very different point of view. You know, they're the customers, but GAs as the creators would like to be involved in this. So I thought that was a good move. I don't know if any of our faculty or, you know, Chris, do you have any thoughts on how you use GAs and whether this is a group we might want to reach out to, at least for awareness building? And
Yes, I mean, different departments handle their arrangements with GA teaching in different ways, and so it might be best to approach this at the departmental level through department heads and graduate directors. Mm-hmm. But it would also be worth liaising with the dean of the graduate school about the general question of disseminating information about what we're doing.
Pat?
As you were speaking, I was thinking about the fact that the library is asked to do a piece of the new faculty orientation. And in that, new faculty may or may not have all of their courses fully developed or are sort of not as potentially invested in what they've already developed. They might be a good group to try to include in our outreach efforts.
I think that's a wonderful idea. I mean, I just do a 15-minute overview of the library, and we'll include OER, but I think that making special efforts to get the list of new faculty and reaching out to them is a great idea.
Representing for the Board of Regents of Higher Ed, we are currently working on a small pilot granting opportunity for faculty within the math department to follow suit to a model that Housatonic Community College has put forth. I think I've spoken at length in the past about how Housatonic has made a departmental-wide shift from Pearson's My Math Lab distribution and accompanying textbook to My Open Math homework platform, and then an open source workbook to associate that. So the small grant is to have other folks from the other schools within the Board of Regents follow the similar model, with the Housatonic faculty serving as mentors for those folks. And there are some other schools that are already working on this. Tungsus is represented in the room, and they've already had one faculty adopt, and I believe Middlesex is in the process of adopting the same model as well. Beyond that, I want to just recognize Housatonic Community College, because they have been named an award winner from Achieving the Dream. They're one of, let me see if I can cheat here, they were one of 38 community colleges across the nation that were selected for an OER grant opportunity. So this was just announced June 14th. I don't have the particulars on the purpose of the grant, but I'll get some information and distribute that. And then from the Connecticut Distance Learning Consortium side, personally, I've been accepted to speak at the Open Education Conference in November in Richmond, Virginia. So that is a great honor for me. That's the updates I have.
I'll just further state, since you've sort of opened the door, reminded me, University of Connecticut was also accepted by OpenStax to be part of their advisory and working group. I think there were 40-something applications, and there were about 13 slots. So we're really pleased to be able to participate at a significant level with OpenStax. I wanted to just make another announcement, not having to do with what's going on at each institution, but referring us back to our charge. You'll note that not later than July 1st, we are to be submitting a report. Well, it's later than July 1st, and so Kevin and I were both reminded about this, but we didn't need reminding. We're working on it, and did talk to Representative Haddad. We obviously started quite a bit late, and we'd like to have a little bit more substance. This task force requires two reports, one in July and one in October. So I'll just go over briefly to remind you all what it is that should be in our upcoming report, which we will likely be submitting to you in draft sometime in mid-August. So you know, that will Kevin and I will work on it together. Technically, each of us are to report. This is supposed to be a report to the Board of Regents and then a report to the President of the University of Connecticut, although it seemed best to be consistent, have a single voice, even though there are two, so that we'll still be able to call out what activities took place at each of our representative, the BOR and the BOT, what affects them, but having it done together is something that we made a decision about. And Kevin has a great outline going. So the report should include an analysis of the potential savings to students for courses using an open source textbook in lieu of a traditional college level textbook. We won't have a lot of data like that, but we can certainly, we have heard from many of our speakers, and we've distributed lots of materials that we can report on, you know, nationally what the findings are. I have at the University of Connecticut one entire department, chemistry, that has written and distributed an open source textbook, all 500 students in the three semester course will be taking it, so I can have specific dollar attached at least to one textbook, and you know, so one high enrollment gen ed course to contribute. And if any of you have other examples at your institutions where you know an open textbook has been adopted and we can compare it with the cost of the previous one, that would be very helpful to put into our report. So the other one was the identification of any barriers to the effective use of open source textbooks by students and faculty. Once again, we can rely upon the information that we've gathered and pull that together, but I'd like to hear from all of you what you think, and part of the survey questions try to get at that, but I doubt that by our August deadline we'll have those surveys. I don't know, Kevin, do you want to add anything to our report?
Sure. So the basic structure that we're trying to put together is we are trying to at least open up with a broad statement of where we are in Connecticut, but the meat of the report is going to be on quantifying awareness campaigns that individual institutions have been doing. And then beyond that, to what the report specifically asks for, quantifying what type of OER adoptions happened to date on campus. And while it's easier to do straight-out replacement, this item replaced this item, so there's a net cost savings, I do intend to include stories that I know of around affordable by design. So a faculty member from Eastern designed a new course with affordability in mind, so there wasn't a necessary comparative cost savings piece to be done, but it should be recognized as well as the efforts at Western and all the other institutions as well. And I do want to thank the Council for Library Directors in helping me gather information throughout the Board of Regents.
One thing that I haven't pursued lately is since March, when we had our luncheon and we did a survey at Eastern and you spoke, and is whether any faculty have actually moved away from commercial textbooks to not necessarily a swap out, like a one for one, but more what you were talking about with that one particular faculty member. I think we may have more, you know, maybe it's a case of asking them every so often, you know, because asking them once, you get a certain group of people, and some of them were just getting the idea that, oh, maybe what I'm doing is OER. So it might be a good idea to kind of periodically remind them and see if there are other people doing this.
Is it appropriate to suggest that if we could develop a very simple question that could be circulated in this way periodically to faculty, that one of the achievements of this task force could be to set up a system for kind of monitoring this and keeping tabs on it over time? The problem being exactly as Pat says, is we can ask the question once and it tells us something, but it doesn't tell us what trends there are or what people have in mind or whether campaigns for awareness about this are sinking in or are simply having very periodic effect.
I think that's a great idea. Obviously, our survey is meant to give baseline data and will give us, you know, some information about awareness, not necessarily adoptions. So thinking more about a methodology moving forward, and I don't know, maybe that's another working group at some point in time, or someone can, or we will find that there's one out there already that we can use ourselves. I think once we get a distribution list down, then we'll have a mechanism for at least distributing questions, and we wouldn't want to, just the one question or two questions on a periodic basis doesn't seem onerous.
Well, something that we did at Eastern a few years ago in regard to a large grant that we got was to create a community of interest. And I was kind of thinking of that when we had the luncheon for the faculty. There were people that were doing this, and it would be nice somehow to kind of get these people together with some regularity and maybe grow the group, because that did help keep the initiative alive, for which we were granted this fairly large amount of money a few years ago, as people met, you know, once a semester at least, and discussed what they were doing to move this forward. And that did kind of encourage people not to forget about it.
Chris, how do you think department chairs would feel about bringing this up, a couple of times a year at your department meetings, or having someone come and ask the question? Or I'm just wondering if there's, surveys don't always, people, hit delete pretty fast, but I'm just curious as to, from your perspective as a chair.
Well, I think to be able to do it regularly but not frequently is probably the ideal, and so we might be talking about something that is done every couple of years rather than twice a year. And the problem is, as Pat has said, that keeping a community of interest going, that could be sort of the thing that keeps us at this. But then the idea is that we would use this tool to reach the people who aren't coming to the meetings but who are actually doing what we're asking them to do. And those are, two very different things, because people are very busy. They don't necessarily want to come and talk about what they're doing. They just want to get on with it. But it would be helpful to find out what they're doing from time to time. And I think a simple question every couple of years is probably enough for us to find out whether this is catching on or whether it needs to be reinforced in some way.
And I might make the bold suggestion that we ask our guest speaker, Jeremy, when he's up on the hot seat, what the University of Massachusetts at Amherst has been doing to keep track of new adoptions, new faculty entering into this realm.
But if I might add, the remark that was made about new faculty orientation, I think, is a very important one, and that is actually something we should make sure we do every year at new faculty orientation, is to have someone, possibly a faculty member, just come and speak very briefly about the need to be conscious of the cost of materials for students. And, you know, faculty are, you know, if they are conscious of that, they will start to work out for themselves how to accomplish that in their particular contexts. We don't have to tell them how to do it, but we do have to tell them that it is in the interest of the state and of the people of the state and of the students and of the institution that we are making reasonable efforts to save students money in this way, because that is important for educational policy, higher educational policy.
I think in that context, which I think is an excellent way to go about it, because faculty are very interested in what other faculty are doing, especially new faculty coming in, the more junior ones particularly. And that might be a good context to have maybe some kind of a link or a handout to the library guide to OER, which is an attempt to round up a lot of, you know, reputable sources of OER, because that seems to be a sticking point. Yeah, people are willing, but it's hard to go out and find all of this. And if there's already a guide, that could be a starting point. I know my guide, for example, is not the be-all and end-all. There are other sources, but indeed, I'd be happy to hear from faculty that there are these other sources in their discipline that I could add to the guide.
Great. So I think we'll just stay on the on our update topics and go with a schedule reminder. And I think it would be useful also for us immediately after the meeting just to sort of send a note out that just reminds people when the next meeting is, since there are folks who aren't here and it's hard to keep our calendars straight. So do we have another meeting scheduled? I don't think we do, Mariette. So we had said we were going to try to meet with some frequency over the summer, but it's obviously not all that effective. I think there are so many folks who are on vacation.
Since the meeting today, should be we're looking for the work groups to really start engaging.
Go ahead.
Should we look for 30 days out? So mid-August for the next time to reconvene. So August 12th is a Friday.
And we would, so then putting out a note to all the members, and maybe Marianne could help us with that, that the next meeting will be August 12th at 1 o'clock. We'll have to confirm room availability, and that we will be hearing from the subcommittees. Primarily, so I think that one of the primary agenda topics should be one from the content subcommittee. So for the survey, and if indeed you know they have something online, you know, in their email communications that we could agree to virtually, then we could actually get the operations group going. But if not, at the very least, let's assume that by mid, I know you're going to reach out, you're going to talk to these folks, but let's sort of put a tentative agenda item at the top of the list for a report August 12th from the content group. And, of course, if you haven't been able to pull them together, well, I'll do something else.
Okay, great.
So if Jeremy, if you're comfortable in going a little bit early, I would love to have introduce Jeremy Smith from University of Massachusetts at Amherst. The center seat is yours. There is a red button to enable your mic. And so I'm not going to do justice to introducing Jeremy. Jeremy is all things UMass Amherst OER, along with Marilyn Billings. He's part of the Boston Library Consortium. He was a guest speaker at the Mass Go Open initiative earlier in June. He's been part of the open ed community on a national scale, and I believe you presented at this last event in Vancouver back in November. So
We didn't present at that, but I was at ALA recently.
That's good. I apologize. So with that, Jeremy, I'll give you the floor.
Sure. So, Kevin, you did a pretty good job of introducing me. Just a brief background on how I came to this position. I was working in the library, actually, in the archives, and Marilyn Billings, my supervisor, had started the Open Ed program in 2011. I think she saw a webinar and got really excited about it. And if you know Marilyn, she's a very enthusiastic person, and it's infectious. So she infected the rest of the library and got the provost excited and our director of the library very excited, and just sort of launched into the program not knowing much about it. And so we used some money. The provost gave us a slice of money. The library had some money, and we started a incentive program, essentially. We gave small grants, $1,000, $2,500, based on class size. So the larger class sizes got more money, and sort of grew the program. And we were doing, I think we did semester by semester, and then we skipped a year. And then we picked it back up in 2014, so we didn't do any in 2013. And we've done a total of 6 cycles of those grants. And, you know, most of the time we've been able to fund everyone who applies. And, you know, if there's maybe one or two people who couldn't make it because of the money, Marilyn finds some money somewhere, $1,000 here or there. Or we, you know, decide that this person doesn't really need money. We could probably support this person's efforts to create an OER or find OER without the grant money. So that's that. We did target last round in last spring. We targeted gen eds. So we thought maybe we could go after some of the large gen ed classes and see if we could impact those. Because, you know, they're generally bigger and they oftentimes hit. A lot of the open ed resources, as you probably know, are geared not necessarily towards majors in those fields. So the OpenStax textbooks, which you may have heard of, those generally are geared towards non-majors. And that's one of the things faculty have said to us. They say, well, we like the OpenStax, but we can't really use them because they're not for bio majors or whatever. So we did target gen eds, and that was sort of the first time we did that. And now I'm collecting data on all the gen eds and seeing what books they use, what textbooks they use, to try and sort of narrow it down, because there's several classes in that are gen eds that really wouldn't be appropriate for OER, you know, like literature classes and things that are reading in copyright texts. So, but the ones that are using commercial textbooks potentially are. So I'm going to sort of narrow down all the gen eds, and we're going to maybe target those. That's sort of the scope of our program. I can talk more about certain things if you want, but you may have questions.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
So as you're targeting these gen ed courses, are these courses where the faculty team or the course is only using a single textbook? So if there are multiple sections of it, mm-hmm. are you finding that there's one textbook, or are there already like 3 or 4 different textbooks if you have 70 sections?
Yeah, it varies. Some departments say use this textbook, and they do. Other times there's a little more freedom for the sections to use different things. So we haven't gotten to that level analysis of all that data to find out how much variation there are between sections. And I think the ones we would be targeting, I think we'd probably be successful if we had someone in the department who was an advocate for it who could help us. And, you know, one place where we have a really good chance of doing that is in physics. We have one person who got a grant early on. He's a real champion of open, all things open. and he has now gotten two other people who he used to teach the intro, he's passed it on, and now the people who are doing it are using OpenStax and doing some other, they're doing videos as well that they're creating. So that may be the approach we take is that, and also we, sort of in conjunction with doing something with the gen eds, we probably need to get going a advisory group. We don't really have that now. Everything is originated from the library pretty much with some help from academic computing and our teaching excellence and faculty development folks. So they are there for support and they tell people about it and they're big supporters. But and there are, you know, last semester actually we got all this interest and queries from the chancellor and the provost. The provost is new, so around 20, our last two rounds, we didn't have support from the provost. She's new. She's sort of feeling her way around. She is being maybe more conservative with money than the last one was. But she got approached by students in the student government and MASPERG, the peer interest research group. And they basically pressured her and said, you know, this is a issue for students and what are you doing about it? So she just sort of helped. She didn't give us any money. She just helped us by promoting it and sending out emails to faculty and that sort of thing. So that was helpful. But we're hoping that with the interest, and the chancellor heard about Tidewater Community College's Z degree, and he said, oh, what's this Z degree? That sounds interesting. So his office is interested. So we're trying to use that interest to generate, to create an advisory board that's maybe, and Marilyn and I have been talking about maybe not necessarily limiting it to just Amherst, but maybe do a system-wide advisory board that would sort of rope in some of the other UMass campuses. So that's, I think, any initiative we do with the gen eds will really benefit from having this advisory group, if we can get it going.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have one or two questions, and I'd be very interested to hear. First of all, how are grants that are made for these things actually used, and what are the people who are not receiving grants but who nonetheless are developing in this area doing that doesn't cost money?
Yeah.
That's my first question. I'll come back later with other.
Yeah, so it ranges from everything from they pay a grad student, they pay an undergrad to do research for them, or they just sort of pocket the money. We don't have many restrictions on what they do with the money. We sort of say, we'll transfer it to your department. You do with it what you wish. So most faculty are open about it, and they tell us what they use the money for. And I think most of it has been to just hire someone or maybe it's compensation for themselves to do work outside of their normal faculty time.
So it's incentive as much as
anything. It's incentive.
Yeah.
It's a carrot.
Right.
It really
right.
is.
Right. Okay.
And a lot of the people who've jumped on it have done it because they're interested. Their interest is piqued in doing something open, and they're interested in saving students money. So they're already kind of primed for that. And then this is just something, oh, wow, I can get a little money for this. Because that's always oftentimes a stumbling block for the people who are interested. They say, well, I don't have the time, you know, I am too busy, I would need to revise my syllabus, all that kind of stuff. So this is just something to do that. The people who we haven't given money, you know, they're popping up here and there, and those are just, they're finding the time to carve out to do stuff. And most of those people, I think, are just adopting existing resources. So they're not creating something from whole cloth. And the overwhelming majority of the people we give money to do a hodgepodge. They don't write a textbook. A couple have, but those are the exceptions. Most of them have, you know, used five chapters from one OpenStax, used library readings, used videos, you know, open source videos or YouTube videos or whatever, podcasts, any number of things, and they sort of cobble together, you know, something for the class. And then the outliers are the people who just adopt the existing thing and then someone who creates something from whole cloth.
So would it be fair to say in the cases that you've just described that this is, in a sense, overcoming the inertia that would lead one to just say, well, we'll just assign a commercial textbook?
Yeah.
And there is more effort involved in putting together what you call a hodgepodge. I'm sure there's a scientific designation
for that.
It clearly does involve more thought and more effort, and this is, in a sense, trying to encourage people to make that effort in the interests of students.
Yeah, and I feel like that is our main role, is to just provide support for those people to get over that hump of, well, I can't do it. Well, we can help, you know, provide technical support, this maybe a little financial support. It's just sort of these various services that the library and other people can offer to sort of move people along.
I did have one or two other questions, but I don't want to hog the limelight. So, you talk about the effort that is going into working on general education courses, and obviously that seems to make a lot of sense because those are the courses which have the largest numbers of students. They are presumably the courses in which that inertial factor is in some ways greatest, right? For faculty, they're working at the most general level with students that who are both going to be majors and who are not going to be majors. But I wonder if you had any experience of the outcome of these efforts in regard to students' expenses on course materials, and the relative value of efforts at the gen ed level and at the upper course level, undergraduate upper level courses, where there will be a higher proportion of majors, mm-hmm. but where, you know, there's still the question of, you know, can we save on materials? It's from a student's point of view, each course, whatever requirement it fulfills, is presumably one of an even number of units, and saving money at each of those is presumably equally important.
Yeah. So you're asking what proportion of both higher and well, we've done about, I guess we've maybe given money for about 100 classes, maybe 50-ish faculty total, and it's run the gamut from intro level to graduate level. So, and those graduate level courses, you know, maybe are using a textbook that's not as expensive, but the faculty member was interested in sort of exploring the open concept. And so they wanted to develop something open or whatever. And I haven't broken down the percentage of those 100 classes, which how many were higher level and intro level. You know, the intro level ones give us the most bang for the buck because, you know, there's 300 students and the textbook's $150. So we can really sort of show how much was saved. But we don't shy away from those smaller 7-person grad level courses where if there's interest from the faculty member, you know, we don't necessarily discriminate. If we were, and the provost actually asked us this, you know, is there more demand than you can fund? And at this point, it's sort of been right on the level. You know, there's only one or two people who we can't fund every time. Now, if it got more popular and word got more widespread and there was more interest, we might have to be more discriminating in who we did fund. But at this point, we're able to kind of, you know, every time it's a breakdown of, you know, 2 or 3 big, large-level intro lecture courses and a couple higher-level courses.
So if I could follow up on that, because, I mean, speaking for myself, I'm learning a lot from what you're just telling us. The money in some ways, as we've already said, is in part for incentivizing, not necessarily for the practical arrangements, although that can be the case. Do you have a sense that there is experience that has been built up of kinds of things that can be done that UMass faculty members can share with one another within and hopefully beyond departments or across departments that would help a scheme like this continue to roll even if there were not financial incentives to keep it going? And or is it the case that, you know, you're going to have to dole out the $1,000 incentive to keep it moving?
Theoretically, yes. You know, you'd have to talk. We get a broad range of responses from faculties, and I guess it depends where they're at. Is it the course they've been teaching for 15 years, and they're using this book, and I like it? And we don't, you know, this is not a, we're not trying to make this some mandatory thing. It's, we obviously want to respect academic freedom, and it's an option, it's an alternative. If you're interested, if you're concerned about the high cost of the, you know, materials for your class, this is an option, it's an incentive. But theoretically, I guess, if there was a cohort of, you know, faculty and maybe librarian people who, because that kind of does go on, those people who we don't fund, and we, you know, occasionally we hear about people who are just have gone off on their own to do it. And I think, and they've gotten maybe support from, they've approached the IT department or the library or somebody and said, I'm really interested in doing this. And we've been able to sort of say, oh, and we can give you money. So for instance, as an example, we had someone who wanted to write a cancer biology textbook, and he came to us before he knew about the grant. And he wanted to, he had this technical issue to overcome. He wanted to collaborate with some of his peers at other institutions. So he said he wasn't familiar with the technological way to do that. And so we sort of suggested, oh, he'd do it on a blog. And, you know, so the academic computing folks basically helped him start that up. So there are existing resources that don't necessarily cost money. So, you know, theoretically, if there was some kind of way to funnel people and figure out what they want to do, you know, we're just, in this particular case, the people who come to us were able to say, oh, and you should apply for this grant we have coming up. But there are a fair number of people who just are motivated to do it even without that money. This is, we're trying to use this to get those people who aren't, you know, motivated without the money. And it sort of sparks the idea, oh, maybe I could do this. And, you know, we're always trying to, experimenting with new ways to do that. So we're actually right now in a pilot project with the Open Textbook Network. And they have this, they're working with this software called Pressbooks, which is built on WordPress. And it's essentially a tool to help you create textbooks using blogging software. And from that, you can, it structures it in a way that's very book-like. It's got chapters and index and all that sort of stuff. And you can output in multiple formats, PDF, EPUB, that kind of thing. So I think what OTN and Pressbooks are doing, they're trying to close that loop of the faculty who want to write a textbook but feel like, well, if you, I need copy editing, I need graphic layout, I need copyright clearance, all that stuff. And this pilot project is trying to see if maybe using a combination of people in the Open Textbook Network and doing kind of a crowdsourcing type thing to maybe work on that. So it's an experiment, and they're collaborating with us and a few other schools.
So I have a question about process and infrastructure. Can you talk a little bit about what you're building for, from a process perspective and an infrastructure perspective of how you're really making this scalable? So is it the librarians, instructional designers, academic, you know, tech folks, or who is the team that's working with the faculty member? It sounds like the finances aren't necessarily going to process. It sounds like it's going more to the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
But so you must have a whole team that's set up in order to make this manageable.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and a lot of it is built into some of the work that people already do anyway. You know, faculty support is what the instructional designers, the IT folks are already doing anyway, so this is sort of within their wheelhouse. The library didn't have that infrastructure, or, you know, Marilyn sort of just carved it out of nothing. My title is digital project manager, which is a very generic title. We were trying to get some more funding from the provost to create an actual open education librarian, which we haven't been able to successfully do one yet. So just moving me into this area was kind of just this little shell game that we were playing to get someone working on it, because it was too much. It was growing so much we didn't really have the infrastructure in the library to handle it, so we kind of had to be creative with that. But before that, we, you know, Marilyn did a little bit. We had a resident librarian we had some grant money for. She was doing some of it. She was always bringing in the liaisons to help with that, because they're natural allies for this sort of thing, because they're the ones who are really the foot soldiers with the faculty. They're in the departments. They know the people. And as long as they have it in their mind to bring it up, they're always out there talking to faculty, and we're always telling the liaisons, you know, oh, make sure you mention open ed and that kind of thing. So some of this fits into what people already do, and then, you know, I'm kind of like a coordinator of a lot of the different things, and making sure things move along and talking to different constituencies. So that I'm really the only one who is sort of like a new position, and it just sort of worked out that financially in the budget at UMass that I was able to kind of move into that position. Does that answer your question? Did you want more?
Well, I guess, is the librarian group working with the faculty to, and then they go off and find everything, and then the academic tech folks actually build something? So from a process point of view,
We're the triage. So we give them the grant, and we say, here's your options. So when we send out the award letter, we say, if you want to do this, talk to them. If you want to do this, talk to them. It seems my experience lately has been a lot of the faculty have a clear determination. They've decided ahead of time what they want to do. They know what they want to do, and they're going to use the money. And you know, maybe they check in with the liaisons to look up some stuff in databases, or we make sure to pass them on to those other places. So we don't have this. We tell them what resources are there, and we leave it up to them to decide whether they want to use them or not. And it's a mix of people who do and don't. So the liaisons are really helpful, because a lot of faculty aren't necessarily tuned into the services that the library does offer, like interlibrary loan and reserves and databases and that sort of thing. This is a nice opportunity to get them to look at those suite of services and say, we're finding a lot of faculty discovering for the first time resources they didn't know we had, which is always a challenge for the library to sort of keep faculty abreast of that sort of thing. So it's nice for that. But basically, the short answer to your question is all those people are willing to work with us, and we can feed faculty to them if that's what's needed for the project.
Has anyone started with Open Ed and then gone back to their regular textbooks?
Yep.
So why?
The example I can think of I mentioned before was they used the OpenStax and decided it was not for majors, or it was more, they wanted something more calculus-based or something for, or the economics department at UMass has sort of like a Marxian focus, so the economics textbook was not appropriate for them. So they didn't actually try it out, but they knew ahead of time that it wasn't appropriate. So, but that's, I would say, the minority. The majority are people who keep on using it. You know, a lot of the faculty we've worked with are sort of junior, well, I don't want to say a lot, but the junior faculty sometimes switch classes anyway, so they're on a class for a few years, or the class goes away, or it's under-enrolled or something. So it's a mix. But we just did a survey of everyone, not everyone responded, but everyone who's done the grant, those 50-plus faculty, and the majority of them continue to use in that class and others. So they've sort of, through the process of going through the grant, they've discovered, oh, this isn't so hard, I could do this in another class. So they've sort of transferred some of that open ed thinking or low cost resources thinking to other classes. But there have been a few that have not, just it wasn't appropriate. And you know, in the future, the open ed landscape is constantly changing. There's new material being created all the time. So, and we sort of are the ones who are, you know, someone says, oh, this wasn't appropriate because of X. You know, when something new comes out, we sort of maybe go back to those people and say, oh, there's now a new resource that you might find appropriate.
I have a couple of questions. First, to start off, can you give us a sense, with the program now almost 5 years plus,
mm-hmm.
what's the grand scale of dollars you've saved students, number of courses, sections? Do you have that handy?
Mm-hmm. I have it here. I think I know most of it. But so, like I said, 50 faculty plus about 100 classes, and we've invested about $101,000 and saved and about $1.4 million. And that's based on, you know, the number of students and then continuing to use it over time. So, which some people have questioned whether, there's different ways to measure, but that's the total with faculty continuing to use it maybe one or two other times since they got the initial grant. It's about an average of $128 per student saved. And the satisfaction levels from the students are as good, if not better, with the class. And students really appreciate. We hadn't historically, but we're going to make sure to do this every time now, send out a poll to all the students in the class who we fund, the OER class. And we get some really good data from them about, oh, I really appreciate this. And we also ask them questions about their other classes, you know, what they're doing in lieu of buying textbooks. And we, you know, this last time we asked them, in other classes where the textbook is too expensive, what do you do? And we gave them sort of different options. And the number one answer was illegal downloading, which was, you know, good to make the survey anonymous because they were confident saying that. And, you know, they did use interlibrary loan and e-reserves and that sort of thing, but that was the majority, and then not take the class, things like that. So it was definitely affecting their academic decisions. So that's a good amount of data. But, yeah, all the students have been satisfied with it. And, yeah, that's sort of mostly the numbers part of it.
Have you found any particular barriers for faculty adoption? You know, we've had a lot of conversation about lack of supplemental materials, and mm-hmm. if that's one of them, how did you overcome that?
I guess to my knowledge, there's been a few, and we're not, some people have opted to use a service. And OpenStax, Rice University, they've recognized that as well. So for all their textbook now, they're partnering with companies that offer, you know, testing and that sort of stuff, which seems to be the big one. And especially in mathematics, I know My Math Lab is really popular. And I just heard about an open source math test bank thing that I haven't looked at yet. But so, you know, things are always changing, cropping up. And sometimes there just isn't an open resource for it. And, you know, you have to accept that. And as long as it's reducing something, you know, so with the physics folks I mentioned, they're using a commercial testing service, but they're using the OpenStax. So it's going, you know, they're saving the students money on the book, but they're paying $35 or whatever for the. So it's still saving money. You know, it's not like a zero-sum game. We're not trying to just eliminate every textbook cost. That's just every educational supplemental resource cost is just impossible to do. So we find things when we can and, you know, don't necessarily frown upon. And the other thing is, like, the eye clickers. That's a big one. Do you guys know what that is? That's like a polling thing, in-class polling thing, and the students have to buy those. So I sort of explored recently if there were open alternatives to that, and it's a technological issue with the Wi-Fi at UMass. Otherwise, if there was reliable Wi-Fi and security, they'd be able to do it. But so we're always looking at new things, but it's not always possible.
Do you mind if I just ask you to elaborate slightly on the numbers that you've given?
Mm-hmm.
The 1.4 million in savings and the $128 average per student. Mm-hmm. Is the 1.4 million calculated over the 5 years?
Yes. So
right.
The classes we funded last semester, they've only taught it once, so
right.
It's total for that class. Now, I don't know what the maximum number of times, so say that first cohort, 2011, how many times. Some of those were only taught twice or three times and then gone away, or some have continued.
But this is an attempt at a cumulative saving, right?
Yeah.
And the $128 figure, is that, again, sort of cumulative to students over the course of their 4 years, if they've done 4 years yet?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And we actually tried to do a survey. That's a hard data to come by. There's this figure going around that everyone uses of $1,200 is how much students spend per year. And 1,200, 1,300, it's going up and down. The College Board came up with that, and we used that. But I tried to do a study of what, like, a typical course load for the top five majors at UMass. So, but selecting the course, you know, load for 4 years for a typical student is really impossible to do. They change majors. There's transfer students. You don't know what gen ed they're going to, you know, electives they're choosing, all that sort of stuff. So for a particular major, and people change majors, they're double majors. So there's so many complicated ways to be able to calculate that. But and also we switched over to Amazon just for the first. We're using Amazon as our book provider now, starting in last fall. And that kind of threw some, which theoretically is a good thing because it could potentially save students money, you know, but it's still sort of, the jury's still out on whether that is actually happening for Amazon.
Thank you.
I have a technology question.
Mm-hmm.
Really quick. Are you creating all of these open source materials and compiling them into a CMS, a content management system?
Some of the faculty offer them through the LMS, the learning management system, like Moodle and Blackboard. Yeah, those are being, it depends on whatever it is. But theoretically, yes. As an example, the faculty member who created a probability textbook, he just has it on a website. So, you know, it's linked out as the learning management system. And mostly the faculty do use the learning management systems as their sort of portal into whatever it is, if something doesn't exist.
So you're not compiling a large database of OER materials that each, let's say you had an OER option for English that every faculty member could go in and peruse from a content management system?
No.
They can?
That we do. That,
okay.
Our website, the library website has a page on it that is all about open education resources, and we've broken things out by, you know, as much as we can. A lot of that's the thing is the, I think I said this in Haverhill, there's no Google for open ed at this point, so there's no one-stop shopping. So what we try to do with our website is give them the links in one cohesive place where they can look and try to index it as much as possible by the discipline, but that's not always possible. A lot of times these are just links to other databases where they can search, and that's just the way it is at this point. So, yeah, we do as much of that as we can. And anytime we hear about something new, we add it. But I actually don't know how much the faculty use that. Like I said, when they come to us, they've usually thought about this and have an idea. And then they sort of say, so I'm doing a German language class, and we watch German films, and I was using this book, but I didn't want to use the films in the book, so, you know. And then we are able to direct them, well, we have these database of, you know, films and blah, blah, blah. And so we sort of direct them. We kind of figure out what they want when they come and meet with us. So that's really important, actually, is to sort of meet with them to figure it out. I don't know how many just go on our website and look for stuff and find things on their own. I'm sure it happens, but I think, yeah, I'm not sure.
Thank you, Jeremy. We've learned an awful lot about what you've done at UMass and have taken some of it and are running with it, as well as some of the work at Open Textbook Network, which I'd like to talk to you a bit about. So I do want to call the committee's attention to the open.ucon.edu. That's a page that we have, our summer competitive incentives for faculty from the Affordable Textbook Initiative. So we have, you know, grants such as you've described for reviewing an open textbook, grants for transitioning a course, and they really are similarly modeled to what you have done. So we'll add to the knowledge base of how that works out. This is first for us, so we're now accepting applications. Mm-hmm. We do ask that there be follow-up, and we'll be posting the assessment for each one on the website. And there's an application process. So for those of you who might be interested in process and structure, if you go to that page, you can find out how we're doing it and how we're accepting applications and choosing and so on. Mm-hmm. But we're learning. And your comment about the supplemental materials, and you know, we have a similar, our chemistry department all adopted an open chemistry textbook, one that was actually remixed, rewritten in order to have the Adams First focus, which is how the UConn teaches, and will now be back available on OpenStax, but still have to use Adams for, Alex. Mm-hmm. So it's not a zero course, but it's at least $200-something less than it was before. So you know, we make progress, and sometime there might be a replacement for Alex, and I'm sure that because the department's so interested in it, that would be something they'd consider.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why it's nice to use the word affordable, not necessarily, you know, so free or whatever.
But I would like to, I'm particularly interested, too, in the relationship that the BLC, for those of, you know, it's the Boston Library and Consortium, but it goes well beyond Boston. That was where it grew up from, the University of Connecticut, Senate, University of New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and UConn is certainly active members in the BLC and supported the consortium joining the Open Textbook Network.
Mm-hmm.
So we're consortium members, and Jeremy, you are the point person, I believe, for the consortium.
Yep.
Sort of interested in what kinds of, how that might work out for all the members, and maybe even thinking about whether, you know, Connecticut might join as a
mm-hmm.
different kind of member. Not UConn, not one institution, but I think this is the first time they've done a multi-institutional.
No, they've done others.
Oh, they have. So, good. So can you tell us a bit about that, just so it might be something that this group may think about for ourselves?
Sure. Yeah, so Open Textbook Network, do people know what that is? Yeah, I'll give you just a brief background. So this was a program started at the University of Minnesota by a faculty member and a librarian who wanted to sort of solve this repository for high-quality textbooks, and just textbooks. They're only focusing on that. They're not talking about courseware or lectures or anything like that. So it's just textbooks. And what they've been doing is going around to getting agreements with campuses to become members of their network, and then they go to the campus, they give you sort of a overview of how to talk to faculty about this issue and train librarians and others to then go out and talk to faculty. And all the textbooks on their website have reviews from faculty, and how they get those is when you become a member, as part of your payment to become a member, you pay these stipends to faculty to motivate them to write these reviews. So when Open Textbook Network comes, and they do basically two types of workshops when you're a member, they do one for staff and librarians, whoever's interested, and also faculty. And so the faculty one, when they come, people have already signed up. Yes, I'll review the history textbook that you have there. I'll put a review on there. And then they have these sort of methodologies for reviewing the textbook that are pretty standard and are useful for people looking at the textbooks. So, and then the idea is that if they've trained the librarians and staff, they can then do this, you know, forever. So, and then you're a member, and there's an institute every year, so people can go to the institute in the summer to learn more and get even more involved. So the BLC, and UMass became a member. We did our little workshop. We had some faculty come. We trained librarians. And then the BLC became a member as a consortium. So what we did with that is the BLC came and did a day-long workshop. It was open to anyone in the BLC who wanted to come. So we had people from all over. We had some UConn folks. We had BC, BU, Brandeis, a bunch of others. And so they came and they got this sort of, it was a train-the-trainers workshop. And then what BLC is now going to do is offer about, on a first-come, first-served basis, two or three incentives to any of the members of the consortium who want to do a workshop and offer those incentives to faculty to write reviews. So that's what's going to happen. The benefit, so that's a benefit that the members have. The additional benefit of maybe an individual institution becoming a member might be they would do the faculty workshop for you. Right now, it was just all they're doing is training the librarians and letting them do the faculty workshop. The benefit of becoming an individual member is they'll come and do the faculty one also. So that's the really only difference between the consortial and the individual membership at this point. I guess if you had more, that's the sort of overview of it.
So while this, this task force doesn't have any funding, it just did seem to me as though while this group is offering consortial or sort of group memberships where they could come out, it could be that for some of the smaller institutions or any institution in Connecticut who has not yet had any training. So it was something that as we go down the road, I believe that it's about $10,000. This is not an inexpensive membership.
Right.
And so it's something I thought that we as a group might want to consider at some point as we think about how are we going to get training, how are we going to get workshops. And, of course, individuals could join. The University of Connecticut decided not to join individually. We were going to see if we could get it accomplished ourselves by sort of looking at what everyone else is doing. But that's not, I don't think that's the case for every institution in Connecticut.
Yeah, and that would be a benefit for consortial membership, is those smaller institutions who can't necessarily afford that would certainly be able to take advantage of that. And that's sort of was the idea behind this consortial membership.
I had a little bit different question. I'm wondering if you've had any sense over time, given that you've had 50 faculty and 100 classes that have participated in this, is there any sense that the faculty that are doing this are getting any credit in their promotion and tenure efforts? Because that is more valuable than money to many faculty. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's any way to move that forward in some way. It seems like it would be a local decision, you know, institution by institution as to whether something like this has any bearing.
Yeah, it's definitely on the radar, and Marilyn was actually just talking about working with the faculty and tenure committee to somehow move this forward. It's, you know, a complicated process, and I don't know how it's going to go, but I think there's enough faculty who've participated who could advocate for this and say this should be recognized as a valuable contribution to our scholarship as much as writing a book or our regular research or articles or whatever. So at this point, it is not, and that has been a stumbling block for some people. So that's just a longer-term culture shift that's going to have to happen, and you know we've sort of put a few wheels in motion to start that conversation at UMass, and I'm hoping that we have enough, you know, we have those 50-plus faculty to come forward and advocate on behalf and say, you know, basically make the argument that this is a valuable thing. I mean, you know, the faculty member who wrote a whole textbook, he's been invited to speak about it. He has people who use the book outside of his regular classes, just out on the internet, and he gets emails from Africa asking him questions about, you know, this math problem. And so he's had a big impact. So if you measure your scholarship by impact, there's no doubt that these resources are making an impact. So that's the argument we need to make to the tenure folk, people who make those decisions about that.
I mean, it might be worth adding that certainly at a research university, it may be different at a primarily teaching institution because rewards for tenure and promotion are based on research output as well as on teaching contribution. It may be that what needs to be done in relation to OER or affordability is that efforts in this direction are simply recognized as part of a faculty member's teaching contribution. And that posing the question in the form, is this as valuable as publishing a book or whatever, is not really a helpful way of doing it because it won't be, it's not the same as that.
Sure.
In a system which necessarily distinguishes between the two, but making it clear that making efforts on behalf of students, whatever that is, I mean, teaching well, getting them excited about what they're doing, this is one of those contributions which ought to be recognized in the process, but we shouldn't make it so fixed an idea that faculty who are concerned about other things regard it as a stumbling block.
Right. Yeah. Good point.
I'm just thinking also that some of our institutions, in fact, probably most of them, are very concerned about retention. And there's been evidence that this helps students to be retained if they can manage their courses without a huge outlay for their textbooks. So, you know, it might be tied to the university's mission and goals that a faculty member is supporting this in some way. Not that it's going to be the same as publishing an important research article, but that it's tied in, as you say, to the teaching efforts and more broadly to the institution's goals for retention, which it seems like that should be something that the promotion and tenure committee might take an interest in. All the more because we're all squeezed so much in a budget sense that when you lose students, that's not a good thing for your institution.
I think in addition to attention and retention, of course, it's student outcomes. We've heard from some of our other speakers and some of the documents we've distributed that students who actually have access to the text material, the other kinds of open materials, have a greater success rate than those who choose not to illegally download it.
Yeah.
But don't buy it.
Right, exactly.
Or have to share it with a roommate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All of these notes. I want to thank Jeremy because he's running overtime. We asked you initially for 30 minutes.
Oh.
You're going close on an hour. So I wanted to ask one last question unless anybody else from the committee has one. All right, then I'm going to go for as. Representing one of the longest-standing OER initiatives in New England, I have to ask, what are the lessons learned over the last 5 years that you'd want to relay to us? As some of us are at different stages of our OER efforts, what knowledge can you share?
Yeah. Well, I sort of came in late, and one thing I learned early on was I had to kind of cobble together data to do some assessment. So I strongly urge everyone to do assessment from the get-go. I'm sure you would be doing that anyway, but just and gather as much good data as you can and stay in touch with people so you can sort of measure the long-term impact. You know, that's something that we have just started to do. And so when you, if you're funding faculty or when you're working with faculty, make sure that they understand that they'll sort of be part of this experiment and you'll be wanting to know, ask them questions and surveys and data gathering and all that sort of stuff. So that would be number one. And I would also say, I mean, it sounds like you're in a good position. You've got this advisory group. And there are people who are willing and able to help on the ground, on the campuses. But, you know, having as much, trying to get support to find out based on what people want to do. So responding to what you, once you go out and are talking to faculty, then being flexible enough to say, well, you know, there's more people want to do this and not necessarily this. So being flexible, I would say, is important. Yeah, those are some of the main things. You know, and we're still learning ourselves, too. I think in a lot of ways our program is, we've been doing essentially the same thing for all the 5 years, and I feel like now we're at a crossroads where we need to decide how to grow it, how to expand, what... how to reach those faculty who haven't self-motivated to, when they see that email come in, say, ooh, I want to do that. Because there's plenty of people who still don't know, and awareness about OER is still low among faculty. So I feel like we still have work to do to grow the program in a way. It's been successful, you know, with the people who've used it, but we can do more. So I think... you know, always be willing to experiment and grow and rethink how you're doing things, which is, you know, what I think we're at a stage we're doing now. So.
Thank you so much for traveling down here,
Sure.
Going in overtime.
You're welcome.
Answering all our questions, and you know, I appreciate the efforts you've been doing on a larger level with the Northeast OER Consortium that mm-hmm. Marilyn was in part, and yeah. all the organizations you're representing. I think there's some good collaboration going out throughout the region and the country, so let's hope that it continues.
And we've been working a lot recently with the community colleges, you know, as you know, and that's been really exciting that they're getting involved, and we've been... I've been doing a similar thing, passing on what I can to those groups, and they've been really responding to that. So I think, you know, I'm happy to do that here as well, if on a either individual campus level or any of that sort of thing, if I can do what I can.
And I'd like to expand our help, if at all it can be helpful in any way to help out UMass Amherst, please let us know.
I will, for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much from me, too. I'll sort of frame the next question that we have, and Kevin, you have to help me with this. Since our last meeting, we've had requests from three individuals to speak with us. And of course, we have a history. We haven't been in existence that long, so we have a pattern, perhaps, of having folks that we invite come in to educate us and to talk to us about what their efforts have been. We have others in the works. We have an individual from Cal State. So I think we have certainly the desire to the task force members to learn more about this topic, to be good listeners and have a lot of voices be heard. We hadn't in the past been solicited, to come to speak to us, and these particular individuals represented sort of a different constituency group. So I just thought it important, rather than Kevin and I make the decision to bring it to the group. Individual representing NACS, the National Association of College Tours, which described in your handout, and along with that, individuals from Barnes & Noble College. We work with these folks in our institutions, you know, all the time, and so they're colleagues of ours. So I wanted to be sure that we gave these requests due consideration. I know you just received the handouts that describe a bit about the individuals and what they might talk about. So I think perhaps we should just take a break for a couple of minutes and let you review it, and then come back to review the goal, I mean our charge as a task force, and whether or not having these individuals speak to us would facilitate and help that charge. And, of course, you know, we have an awful lot to do. So I'll take a few minutes. Give me a nod when you're done looking at the thing. Did you want to add?
The only thing that I was going to add is that I think that what Martha and I are looking really from the group is some guidance on protocol and procedure. So we've had conversations in the past of identifying individuals as a committee who would have to come in. So whether we decide one way or another, how do we prioritize who is on our speaking docket? Because this committee does have a shelf life.
Well, I'd like to read them, but in general, my general feeling about it is that our goal is to make textbooks more affordable to support open educational resources. If you know, Barnes & Noble or the National Association of College Textbook Stores or whatever it is, we understand they need to make money. But I believe there are places where they will place OpenStax textbooks there, and maybe they take some kind of a service charge on it, but it still helps the distribution. So I don't know. I mean, there may be ways that if we talk about the ultimate goal, that hearing from groups like this might be worthwhile. I think we should keep an open mind.
Since I have it in front of me, I'll just quickly review the charge to us, which was twofold: to assess the use of high quality digital open source textbooks, and two, to promote the use and access to open source textbooks within our respective units. Keeping ourselves on task, but also keeping an open mind.
So one of the questions in relation to the task, and we talked about this a little bit in the last item with Jeremy Smith, are we committed only to talking about something that is called open source, or are we concerned with student access to materials in relation to affordability? If we're only concerned with the first, then conceivably we could argue that these people are not relevant to us, except perhaps under very narrow constraints. If we're concerned about the second, then I think we need to find out what these people are doing. Conceivably, if the open course affordability movement gathers weight, commercial providers, whether they are publishers or bookstores, are going to act in response in some way, and I think it's relevant to our mission to learn what they think is going to happen. I don't think inviting them necessarily offers an endorsement. Nothing we say in a report need advocate making use of services that they provide, but having knowledge of those services and what their strategies might be educational for us.
I'm in agreement with Chris. Depending upon what our true charge is, it may or may not be reasonable to have these individuals testify. I think I'm amenable if we have a specific agenda for them to talk about. So rather than them create the agenda, if they can work with something that we supply. So, for example, if we want to learn about what options they are offering in the digital space related to content complements. So I think one of the things that we learned earlier today is that you're focusing on free textbooks, but you don't necessarily have the complementary summative assessments that go with it. So if we really focused on something very specific for them to talk about, as opposed for them to create their own agenda, and we also give them a time limit, I'm amenable. But I think it has to be very specific and spelled out.
So in looking at the outline, so Mr. Hirschman from NACS was kind enough to give an outline. I would say that just reviewing it, I don't think he needs to spend time sort of telling us what the federal and state policies are. We know that. Or student spending on course materials. We know that. But we might be very interested in what their partnership is with OpenStax. We might be very interested in what their partnership with OpenStax and Dover Publishing with the custom platform for creating the books. I mean, these are my thoughts, and there are maybe some other things that you see in terms of what various college stores are doing. Looking at the Barnes and Nobles, they're obviously paying attention to this. Some of it seems to be more focused on digital and online solutions. I my sense is where it's not so much digital and online solutions as it is, you know, how they support or complement either open. And I think we've already opened the door to affordability, quite frankly, in this group, and have done that without raising any eyebrows from Representative Haddad. I don't think that goes against it. So I believe, to answer to your question, we don't have to say so narrowly focused on open. Certainly affordability, complementary materials, and then what are they doing, but not just in the digital space, in the open space.
Okay. Yes, I do have a couple of comments following from that. One, Richard Hirschman from NACS says that he could talk about student spending and other student course material trends and so forth. I'm wondering if we do know that and whether actually he might have data for us, given what his job is, that we would find useful to receive. I mean, we might ask him to provide it in some kind of written form or tabular form rather than being quizzed about it. But it might be very helpful to know whether the data they have is in line with the data we think we have. With regard to Barnes & Noble, I'm taken with Nicole Guerreri's mention of this thing called faculty and light. I'm always in favor of enlightened faculty. I don't know quite what this means, an online adoption solution. It sounds very chemical to me, but I am wondering whether they're shifting in the direction that we're shifting in, and that is to, you know, how we provide information to faculty. Is this the resource that we're trying to create? And I suppose it might be helpful to find out more about it, because if they've already done the work, maybe we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Now, whether Barnes & Noble have done the job the way we need it to be done is a question. I am wondering whether they're shifting towards not charging students for information, but charging institutions and faculty members. I mean, they're trying to figure out where they're going to get their money from, right? And if it's not coming from students, it must come from somewhere else. So I think it would be rather helpful to come in and hear what they have to say about that.
I think it was Faculty and Light that I saw. I was a part of the committee that reviewed the proposals for the bookstore for University of Connecticut, and it seems like that online tool was a way for faculty to, let's say you're looking for a chemistry textbook, to be able to discover what was out there. So it was sort of a discovery tool, and my understanding was that included in that would be OER. So I would really love to see whether that's true, and we'll certainly find that out on the University of Connecticut campus, because they will be there working with us. So I would have been interested in this either as a member of the task force or as a member of the UConn community, one way or another. But if the task force is interested, then.
I guess the only comments I have is really about process and priority. So if we're open, as it sounds we are, to outside or non-solicited folks coming in, which may open to more, how do we do our vetting process, for one? So it sounds like we have some criteria that we're going to dictate the agenda to some extent. We're going to look for an advanced submission of their presentation so we can actually see the information they want to present. So are we going to do that vetting process as a committee in advance, so they'll submit to us and then they're at least one meeting away from being considered for the agenda? And then my second question about priority is, we've identified folks like Jerry Hanley from Cal State running Merlot and Affordable Learning Solutions. I think we've talked about Lumen, David Wiley or Kim Thanos, OpenStax with Nicole Finkbinder. So there's some other folks in the queue, to so to speak. So again, so the process, the vetting process, and then the priorities. The outstanding question I have for the group.
Well, I think the idea of setting forth the parameters fairly tightly so that they don't stray off into territory that is more germane to their interests than to our interests. But I, you know, I do think that they are a large distribution network and they reach a lot of faculty. And so, of course, they, you know, they have to make a profit to survive. And, you know, one of the questions we might ask is, you know, if you're supporting OER, what's your, you know, funding model within your organization to be supporting this at the same time you're trying to make money? And I don't, there's no sin in making money. I mean, I wouldn't find it offensive if they said we tack on a, you know, a service charge of X. The book is OER, but we need to make some kind of recoverable on giving the space to the OpenStax book in the bookstore. The student is still way to the good. So, you know, I'd be interested in hearing directly, you know, yes, we're doing it, and how are you doing it?
That's great. I think that it's not inconsistent with if we have Lumen Learning come in. I believe Lumen does something very affordable, but they charge like a $5 fee per student. So there's some mechanism in place that helps them stay in business. Is that correct, Kevin?
Sorry, there is a free and compensated one. Free if it's disconnected from their systems, and a low cost one if it's integrated to their systems.
So it sounds like I can get back to these folks and ask them to give us a tight agenda. We will be talking to these other folks, and so may have to kind of massage over the next few meetings who can come when. How long do you think? You said a time frame. Is there a sense of the group of
I would say that they'd have a max of 15 minutes for their presentation, so
okay,
that we have time for questions. And
okay,
I would say that the topic needs to be, what is your role in supporting open educational resources?
Yep.
And that would be the topic. They have 15
yep.
minutes. And I think if you and Kevin get there, basically an outline of what they're going to say ahead of time, you could say yay or nay. And that, I think, makes it far more simplistic. So if we keep it kind of to just a couple things, I think that's a way to streamline it.
15 minutes, and then we'll probably plan another 15 minutes of Q&A. Give us enough time for dialogue.
Yep.
How many of these presentations are we contemplating? You mentioned a number that you'd already got in the pipeline. I'm kind of thinking about the timing in response to Kevin's suggestion, but there's also a kind of advantage to having them lined up in the room, perhaps even watching each other, and having, you know, more than two or three of these presentations at each session.
I just want to clarify that in terms of the three people I've put in front of you, they would like to do this together. So that particular one would be one presentation.
That's one presentation.
Right.
Okay, good.
So that's, and then Kevin can speak to the others.
Well, at this point in time, there's somewhat of a wish list. I know that Jerry has specifically been identified over the last couple of meetings. So my hope with the blessing of this group is that he would be on the August agenda if he's available. Or if not, his counterpart, Leslie Kennedy.
And if neither, maybe someone else.
Correct.
So we'll welcome.
So, is there any more business to be brought before this task force? Wow, we are so good. Look at that. 2 minutes after three. Thank you all very much for your participation. August 12th is our next meeting, and thanks to our support from the legislative support for helping us out with this. And I'll see you all in a month. Take a vacation.